Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll begin our week in review with Governor Deval Patrick's push to rewrite the state tax code by raising income taxes, lowering the sales tax, and proposing big new spending on education and transportation.
We are proposing to invest in accelerated growth. What our residents want is what our Commonwealth needs to be economically strong in the future.
It might be what residents want, but are they willing to pay for it?
You cannot keep going to the well without driving people crazy.
Also, in this presidential inaugural week, President Obama speaks up for gay rights, and Rhode Island, New England's only state without it, moves a step closer to approving gay marriage and embracing a long legacy of tolerance.
So it's time to honor and affirm that legacy by ensuring that same-sex couples can enjoy the same fundamental rights, benefits, and privileges as all other citizens of our state.
And what's being called a triumph for property rights, a federal judge in Boston rejects the government's attempts to seize a family-owned motel in Tewksbury.
This case epitomizes what an aggressive U.S. attorney wielding these laws can do to a small and even innocent property owner like Russ Caswell.
And more trouble for Massachusetts Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray. State finance regulators want to know if he accepted illegal political donations from former Chelsea Housing Director Michael McLaughlin.
I've never asked him to raise money, and if he did, it was wrong.
And as Senator John Kerry prepares to become the next Secretary of State, Boston Congressman Stephen Lynch is poised to join the race to succeed him, maybe, or not. Apparently, he's not sure. So we're going to dive into those stories, that we're sure of that, with our Week in Review team. And joining us now are Callum Borchers, business and political reporter at the Boston Globe. And Callum, great to have you.
Great to be here, Anthony. Thanks.
And also with us in the studio, Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor of the Trotter Review. Welcome to you, Ken. Great to have you.
Great to be here, Anthony.
So, gentlemen, let's start with the race for the U.S. Senate here in Massachusetts. As we know, John Kerry is well on his way toward confirmation as the next Secretary of State. We know that Congressman Ed Markey, the Democrat from Malden, wants to succeed him. We assume that Republican Scott Brown wants to run again. And today we learn that another Democratic Congressman, Stephen Lynch from Boston, might be jumping into the race as well. At least that's what members of his staff indicated. Callum, bring us up to date. Is he in? Is he out? What's going on?
Yeah, he's not sure either, apparently. But if I were a betting man, Anthony, I would probably guess that he's in. That's certainly the direction that we seem pointed in. On the good side for Stephen Lynch, if you look at hypothetical matchups, polls of hypothetical matchups with Scott Brown, he's no farther behind than Ed Markey. But there are a lot of obstacles, too. In a hypothetical primary matchup, he's down by about 10 points to Markey. He's got a huge financial disadvantage as well. Remember, these candidates can use money left over from their congressional races, but Markey's got more than $3 million already in the bank, which is more than four times what Lynch has. Mm. Plus, he's got the backing of Kerry, he's got Vicky Kennedy in his corner, and he's also got the Democratic Senate Committee, which will help raise money for him. So those are the big hurdles that Lynch would have to overcome.
Right. Ken, up until now, I mean, it seemed like Ed Markey close to being the anointed choice of the Democrats. If Lynch does get into the race, what does that do to the race for the Democratic nomination?
Well, it makes them spend more money before the general election, whoever finally prevails, for one thing. But it's not necessarily a bad thing as much as the Democratic establishment would like to winnow the field down to Markey. It means there'll be more of a debate. It'll give Markey, who's been elected for a long time in a single district, congressional district in the state, a chance to broaden his name recognition around the state for people to get to know him. I think it'll be an interesting contest if it comes out. And I like Colin. I assume that Steve Lynch, who wanted to run against Scott Brown the first time around, is in fact going to run this time. But you'll have, you know, Markey, whose appeal is more to the party establishment and activist types, and you have Steve Lynch with a strong appeal to members of organized labor. So it'll be an interesting contest.
Let me ask you about this. You know, we're so used to in this day and age these races that go, these campaigns that go on and on and on. Whatever happens, this is going to be a very compressed race. If Kerry resigns, let's say next week, the election would be scheduled for June, which means a primary 6 weeks before that. So just a few months for a major race like that. Ken, What do you see? What's the effect of that?
Well, I think, you know, you have less of a debate, obviously, so maybe the issues don't get aired as well. And it also gives a great advantage to whichever candidate has the greater amount of money, which in this case is Ed Markey. It's not a very favorable condition for somebody who's an underdog. If you have that little time to get yourself known, get people to like and support you, and to get your people out to win a primary election. So it's collapsed. I mean, there are other people, you know, more with presidential politics than congressional campaigns who get tired of the perpetual campaign.
Yeah, it might be good for the political consumer. What do you think, Callum?
I think it could also be a potential blessing in disguise, Anthony, for the Democrats. And I know that party establishment was kind of hoping to have a very, you know, clear-cut nominee in Ed Markey, or at least a lot of folks were. But the possible good side for them is that by having a competitive primary, it will force the Democratic candidate, whoever the eventual winner is, to really put himself out there into the public eye. I mean, I think these are two men who are well-known within their own congressional districts, but how well they're known statewide is another question. And, of course, Scott Brown is very well-known statewide. So the primary will force one of them to really get into the public eye earlier in the race, perhaps, than just a clear nominee would have.
Well, let's move on, if we can, to other political matters, but this has to do with finances and the state budget, because this week, Governor Deval Patrick and his big push for higher income taxes and a lower state sales tax sort of came to a head when he proposed his $34.8 billion budget for the next fiscal year. Patrick wants to raise a number of other taxes, as we heard, on cigarettes, candy, and soda, but he also wants to eliminate a series of tax deductions. And the overall goal, according to the governor, is to invest huge dollars in transportation and education and other things he believes the people of the Commonwealth want.
Our residents have told us that they want subways that run later into the evening. They want regional buses and commuter trains that run on the weekends. They want bridges that are safe. They want projects that are built more quickly and a system that is more modern. They want safer, smoother roads that are more convenient to drive on and cause less wear and tear on their cars and trucks, affordable housing and recreation, and they want it equitably in all regions of the Commonwealth.
And Callum, they want to call it Shangri-La, too, I guess. no, I take the governor's point. That is the Commonwealth of the 21st century. The question, I'll start with you, Callum, is can he get the legislature to go along?
Yeah, that's a more difficult question. And if you look at the early response, he's getting obviously quite a bit of resistance from Republicans. But even Democrats are being rather wary, aren't they? I haven't seen anybody really give a strong, full-throated support behind this proposal yet. They're saying, well, we're going to keep an open mind. You know, the challenge, I think, is really going to be kind of taking the pulse of the electorate. And I think that where the governor needs to be careful here a little bit is that, you know, he has come out and said, you know, this is not what we want to do up here on Beacon Hill. This is what the people of the Commonwealth have asked for. And so, you know, this is sort of a gamble that he's right about that. He's got to be sure that he's reading the electorate correctly here.
And Ken, what do you make? Do you think he's reading the electorate correctly?
Well, I think, you know, he's for a governor or a president or anyone to propose raising crack taxes anywhere, it's always better to say it's dedicated, the increases are dedicated for particular purposes. That goes down better with people than, you know, general tax increases that could get divvied up in different directions, and people aren't sure if all those purposes are worthy. Certainly there's a lot of concern about the MBTA in this area here and its quality. I live near a bridge project that I think took 3 years to complete and created a traffic nightmare for all that time. It would have been nice to see it done more rapidly. And, of course, education is one of the more popular government services that government provides. And a lot of people feel that it's a worthy thing to do.
But do they want to pay for it? It seems to be at the bottom line, the question, right?
That's the question. And I think, you know, the governor has a sales job to do with the public and with the legislature, obviously.
Well, we got a lot more to talk about regarding the budget in the days, weeks, and months to come, I'm sure. But we're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll look at the big vote in Rhode Island, the Rhode Island's House, I should say, to legalize gay marriage in the only New England state without it. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. This is Radio Boston.
The This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're reviewing the week's news with Callum Borchers, business and politics reporter at the Boston Globe, and Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor of the Trotter Review. So let's move on and talk about the big push for gay marriage in Rhode Island. It's the only New England state without gay marriage, but this week it moved a major step closer toward approving it after the House voted overwhelmingly in favor. The House Speaker, Gordon Fox, who's gay, championed the bill. Governor Lincoln Chafee also supports it. But less certain is the fate of the bill in the state Senate, where Senate President Teresa Piva Weed opposes it. Here she is responding to the vote in the House.
I certainly congratulate Speaker Fox on the successful passage of this legislation this evening. I know that this has been the single most important issue to him this session.
So not exactly a ringing endorsement there from Teresa Piva Weed, but gentlemen, here's Rhode Island, the land of Roger Williams, a long legacy of inclusion and tolerance, but the only New England state without gay marriage. Ken, what's your response to the effort that's going on there today?
Well, I think that I look at it a couple of different ways. One is I think here in New England we ought to understand our exceptionalism, where pretty soon the whole region, or perhaps the whole region, every state, all six of them, will authorize gay marriage, whereas in other parts of the country, the very idea baffles people. I think despite the history of tolerance and inclusion in Rhode Island, it also is a fact that Rhode Island is the most Catholic state in America, and I suspect that has a lot to do with the resistance and may very well shape the outcome of the vote in the Senate, which I think at this point nobody's certain whether we'll go one way or the other.
Yeah, it seems really up in the air. Callum Borchers, what's your view on what's happening in the Ocean State on this issue?
Well, I think Ken's right, and you know, Gordon Fox talked about this sort of quirkiness, as he said, of our little state, you know, where you've got, you know, as he says, this sort of tradition of, you know, wide acceptance going all the way back to Roger Williams, and at the same time, you have some real social conservatism with the very influential Catholic Church, and so it's interesting to see how that dynamic will play out. Also, you know, as opponents of gay marriage in Rhode Island have pointed out, the Senate historically has been, you know, a stronger upholder of sort of the, you know, traditional family structure that they prefer, and as you noted, Teresa Piva Weed is you know, openly opposed to same-sex marriage, although she was congratulatory toward Mr. Fox. She has said that she's going to allow the bill to come up, at least, in the Senate, so it appears that we will get a vote later on in the spring, but you know, the outcome appears to be a real toss-up right now.
Well, there's an interesting and sort of powerful broader context here. Supporters of gay marriage in Rhode Island are hoping to build on the momentum from last November's elections when voters in Maine, Maryland, Washington State all approved it. And of course, earlier this week in his inaugural speech, President Obama spoke out rather forcefully in favor of gay rights. Let's listen.
Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well.
So, Ken, we were talking before we came on the air. I know you were at the inauguration. And as we consider this effort in Rhode Island and other states to legalize gay marriage, what struck you about the president's fairly forceful statement in favor of gay rights this week?
Well, the directness of it, quite frankly. You know, I sit here as an African-American. I'm trying to think of when he said anything so directly about the rights of African-Americans or even Latinos, for that matter, while they sort of suggest that with immigration reform. I think it was bold. I think in this case, perhaps Washington is finally catching up with at least parts of the country, and he's trying to strike a lead. I mean, he's done some things like with legal matters before now, but that was a... In a state of, I mean, an inaugural address for him to make that statement, I think that was pretty big.
Yeah, what do you think, Callum?
Yeah, I was also struck by the boldness, and I think that the chief opposition that you'll hear from groups like the National Organization for Marriage in Rhode Island is that, you know, this sort of, you know, bold statement by the president and this push in Rhode Island is sort of taking your eye off the ball. And we've already heard some of that from that group's leader, Chris Plant, saying, you know what, what's really important in this legislative session is the economy, and our unemployment rate is still, you know, higher than the national average, and those are the things we really should be focusing on. So you're not necessarily going to see a direct debate, perhaps. perhaps, about the merits of gay marriage. It may sort of devolve into maybe a sideshow of this is a distraction and we should be focusing our attention elsewhere.
Mm-mm. Except for the fact that later on this year, the Supreme Court's going to be taking up this exact question in a couple of cases. So it's something that's not going to fall off our radar at the very
Certainly
least.
Not.
So let's move on, if we can, to a case this week that's being called a major victory for property rights. WBUR's own David Boeri reported on this story, so a little bit of background. Last November, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston sought to seize the Motel Caswell in Tewksbury because prosecutors alleged that the building had facilitated a number of drug crimes. They made their case even though the owners of the motel were never charged in the crimes. They never came under any suspicion and claimed they never even knew about the drug activity. Well, this week, a federal judge threw out the case. And here's attorney Scott Bullock, who represented the motel's owner.
This case epitomizes what an aggressive U.S. attorney wielding these laws can do to a small and even innocent property owner like Russ Caswell.
And the U.S. attorney he's referring to in this case is Carmen Ortiz, and Bullock accused her of abusing draconian power of civil forfeiture in the case. So, Ken, let's start with you. What's your reaction to the fact that Carmen Ortiz seems to have suffered another loss here?
Well, I think the motel owner actually deserved a lot of credit for getting
exactly.
a lawyer and getting a good lawyer. And perhaps one of the things that makes this case distinct from many others that involve residents is there was a businessman who had access to lawyers. There are innumerable examples of families who live in residence where a son or a grandson is involved in drugs and property is lost. Or also, and it's a similar kind of situation, living in public housing, grandma doesn't know what grandson is doing, and they get thrown out of public housing. So in this case, I hope this precedent, which springs from the business side of the world, actually gets applied to some of these residential instances, because certainly grandma usually does not know what grandson is doing if he's engaged in drugs.
Yeah, interesting. So it shines light on the fact that these the rationale is used quite frequently in other cases. Interesting. Callum, your response.
I'm also curious to see whether there might be any sort of legislative change coming out of this, and I haven't heard a lot of buzz about that, but if I understand correctly, the interpretation of the law by Ortiz's office was that they were almost obligated to bring this case, that it was the landowner's burden. The burden of proof was on him to show that he was not involved, that he was innocent, which is sort of the reverse, it would seem, from a lot of our other laws, where the burden is, to make an affirmative proof that you were involved, that you are guilty of something. And so I wonder if we'll perhaps see some changes there, because as Ken said, this happened to be a high-profile case with a guy who was able to really defend himself well. Not every case plays out like that.
Well, finally, gentlemen, let's move on. More trouble or more questions surrounding Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray this week. State campaign finance regulators have found evidence that Murray violated state law by accepting political donations from the former Chelsea housing director, Michael McLaughlin. As we know, McLaughlin had to resign from that post after it was learned that he tried to conceal an inflated six-figure salary. But while he was there, he allegedly raised money for Murray, violating campaign finance law. Here's Murray responding to questions from Channel 4.
I've never asked him to raise money, and if he did, it was wrong.
If he did, it was wrong. Now all this follows Murray's announcement last week that he will not be running for governor. Gentlemen, where does this leave the lieutenant governor? Callum Borchers, let me start with you.
Well, I think he's rather disappointed now, isn't he? Because I'm sure that his thought at pulling out of the race was that perhaps he would be exposing himself to less scrutiny, and it doesn't really seem to be playing out that way. I think that he's sort of in a difficult spot right now where, whether he's telling the truth or not, to the outside observer, it seems somewhat implausible that a person would be raising a considerable amount of money for your campaign without your knowledge. Mm. I think that's going to be difficult to defend against in the court of public opinion.
Yeah, what do you see? How do you see this pickle that the lieutenant governor's in, Ken?
Yeah, I agree with Colm there. It's difficult to credibly assert that you didn't know that somebody's raising a lot of money for you. On the other hand, it's the prosecution who would have a burden here and to search for communications that authorize the same or reflected knowledge of the same, that this money was coming from this individual. So I think this is a case where the Attorney General, given her experience with the Tim Cahill case, needs to have her prosecution ducks lined up in order if she's going to go all the way. I think politically, Tim Murray is done.
is done. I think that's probably a fair statement. This leaves us time for our hubbub, that story that fell below the fold this week. Megan, should I start with you?
Sure. Yeah. My hubbub has been inspired by the fact that WBUR right now is in the middle of a special series we're calling Digital Lives, and so it's taking a look at all the ways in which those ubiquitous cell phones and laptops and everything have worked their way into how we live and breathe, essentially. So that's a little bit of background. But the reason why I wanted to bring that up is my hubbub is Sasha and Malia Obama, and how during the inauguration, there were so many sort of camera shots of them on their phones as their father was being inaugurated once again as president of the United States. You know, there they are, like, taking self-portraits and photobombing each other and getting in each other's way. And I just thought, even the first kids, if I can call them that, are living digital lives, although I'm sure their phones are a lot more secure than ours are. That's my hubbub.
The times we live in. Ken.
Well, I want to go back sort of to one of the stories we touched on. One of the things I picked up when I was down in D.C. for the inauguration is that Scott Brown's wife, Gail Huff, is telling her coworkers at WJLA TV station down there that her husband is not running for the Senate because he'd have to turn around and run again in 2 years. Of course, he hasn't said what his intentions are at this point. So at the very least, it seems to mean his wife doesn't want him to run. But her statements also sort of leave open the possibility of a run for governor.
Very interesting. Callum, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, anybody who's a big sports fan, of course, remembers the great Miracle on Ice game from 1980, or if you're too young to remember it, then you've read about it, certainly, as I have. And in February, Mike Arruzzioni is going to be auctioning off the jersey he wore when he scored that amazing game-winning goal against the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. It's expected to go for at least $1 million.
Wow.
$1 million for one jersey. He's also going to be auctioning off his hockey stick and the glove he wore on the podium. He's keeping the gold medal, though. He says that is untouchable. And here's the good news. Frequently when we get a story like this about an athlete auctioning off a high-profile item, it means he's gone bankrupt or some terrible thing and needs the money. He insists that not the case, but that he's just sort of been keeping the jersey in a bag up in his attic somewhere, and he figured that it would make a good nest egg for his kids. So if you're into that sort of thing, you can buy it. It'll cost you a pretty penny, but you can buy it next month in New York.
That was that's a great hubbub, a great victory by an upstart American team against a USSR Russian juggernaut in those days. Thanks for reminding us of that.
Captained by the guy from BU, of course.
That's right. So my hubbub is sports related too. Pedro Martinez, I know it's been reported, isn't exactly below the fold, but I'm really pleased that Pedro Martinez is coming back to the Red Sox. Multiple Cy Young winner, one of the stars of the great 2004 Red Sox team that won the first World Series since 1918. He's going to be a special assistant to Ben Cherington. So what does this mean on the field? Well, sadly, nothing. But he's still Pedro. He's a lot of fun. He'll be in the clubhouse. Maybe he can loosen them up and sort of change that clubhouse atmosphere that clearly didn't serve them very well last year. So
maybe we'll get to see his winning smile more often,
There you go. We're glad Pedro's back anyway. Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, editor of the Trotter Review, thanks so much for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Great to be here.
And Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe. Great weekend to you. Thank you as well.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Well, stay with us because coming up, we'll talk about the challenges parents face when it comes to finding childcare workers that they feel safe with. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.